I think that it is actually an absolute impossibility for Bitcoin to remain a store of value, medium or long term, if we don't also get it to win as a medium of exchange.
Hello, I am Cody Ullingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. My guest today is Hubertus Hofkirchner. Hubertus is an economist and entrepreneur from Austria. Hubertus is a key figure in developing the BitCredit protocol, an open source initiative focused on building a flexible credit money layer on top of Bitcoin for enabling businesses to finance working capital needs using bills of exchange and e-cash. Hubertus, welcome to the show.
Hi, Cody. Thanks for the kind introduction and happy to speak to you again.
You know, I keep having these conversations with both Bitcoiners and people close to the traditional banking world who seem to talk over each other when it comes to the question, why is Bitcoin not being used in the real economy? The real economy, of course, refers to the creation and exchange of non-financial goods and services, thinking farms, factories, schools, hospitals, that kind of thing. And as we know, Bitcoin is an incredible long-term store of value. It's hard money, but there are still almost no supply chains or service contracts priced in Bitcoin. And for the most part, businesses don't want to have anything to do with it. What is missing from this equation, Hubertus?
Yeah, well, thanks for the question. As you say correctly, I guess the central bankers, whenever they are, so to say, I mean, I had this story recently, for instance. There was the Europeans, as you may know, are currently desperately trying to get a CBDC, the digital euro, off the ground. And there was this guy on stage from the EZB presenting this chart, you know, where they show the various quantities of digital money out there in terms of market capitalization. And on top, of course, there was Bitcoin, yeah, with its $2 trillion plus dollar market cap. And then came already Tether, or US dollar-based digital currency. And then they showed this, I don't know, 1% or so maximum layer of stablecoin euros. And they kind of said, yeah, the EZB needs to do that now because otherwise we're going to be left behind by the Yanks and the dollars doing it all. So I kind of felt compelled to ask the slightly provocative question, guys, you can see that nobody wants a digital euro. On the other hand, Bitcoin is 20 times bigger than the digital dollar. So why don't you join the winning team instead of trying it there? And the answer is the same always. They say, we can't do that. Bitcoin is too volatile. Yeah, that's the explanation, and it's true. Yeah.
So this volatility question is really quite interesting because I just was rereading the classic Austrian economics text, Denationalization of Money by Friedrich Hayek, which is a seminal piece. It came a little bit later. It came in, I think, around the late 1970s, that book came out.
Yeah, 76 and 78 in the second version. Yeah.
So I was having a look through that, and really this idea of volatility. Again, it's the words that are coming out of the mouths of central bankers when I talk to them about Bitcoin. And it's also the thing that just normal people seem to have an issue with is volatility. And from a Bitcoin perspective, I understand, you know, that's kind of the price of, you know, riding the wave. You know, it is price discovery. This thing is going up and up over the long term. But trying to contextualize this in a business sense, stability is incredible. There's a reason why central banks have price stability targets, for better or for worse, and maybe we can dive into the Austrian take on what that actually means. But stability doesn't come that often in nature. It's not really something that we have around us. And so when you do find it, it's incredibly valuable. So maybe you can tell me more about how stability, price stability at least, plays into this idea of supply chains and businesses.
Well, yeah, that's this huge topic, Cody. Maybe first of all, why is it so important for businesses to be able to adopt Bitcoin that we have a stable currency, a stable money?
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
The answer is quite simple. Many businesses, depending on industry, have very low margins. Like, for instance, if you take wholesale, sometimes they work on a 2, 3, 4% margin. 4 is already high. And you can imagine if they do some business and Bitcoin, you know, fluctuates something like 10% in a matter of days or maybe even a single day, that simply would wipe out that company. Yeah, and the companies are the infrastructure, the supply chains are what gives us our abundance. This is why most people nowadays can live a fairly good life, a life which was unimaginable not so long ago. So that's the problem of volatility. It's a very hard problem, and that's why central bankers focus so much about it. But not only they. Yeah, it was also in the Austrian school very clear that you need a stable money. Mises said it multiple times in Theory of Money and Credit already in 1912. The whole debate at the time was how do we get to a stable currency in 1912, because gold was getting scarce for certain reasons, and which we can go into if you want, and which caused deflationary pressures, which again caused a so-called deflationary spiral, whereby businesses shut down one and the after, and essentially there's misery, hardship, people can't get food, stuff which we need and which we're used to can't be produced. That's why you need a stable money. And Hayek, since you mentioned denationalization of money, was also very clear about. It says you cannot have a stable money if the supply of money is fixed. And if you don't have a stable money, then you don't have abundance and you don't have full employment. So that's simply a fact, and Austrians have always said it.
Yeah. So I want to maybe start here just to dive in, and again, to contextualize this role of Austrian economics in the foundational, how would you say, ideology of Bitcoin. Now, we talk about Austrian economics. There's actually two schools of thought here, right? There is the Hayekian school, which is really concerned around the problems, coordination problems, the importance of price, the incentives. And then there's the Rothbardian school, which is this idea of property rights, of justice, and that side of things. And I think maybe we can talk a little bit about those two, because I think most people involved with Bitcoin would agree that Austrian economics has played a role, at least ideologically, theoretically, in the development of what we call Bitcoin. But as you say, the idea of a fixed supply, 21 million, certainly is not what Hayek talked about. It is part of the puzzle, though. And so there's nuance there. So maybe you can expand on just so those two schools of thought and how those have influenced our view on Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think the problem is just one of a gap. I think all Austrians, Rothbardians, Hayekians, Misesians, we all agree that a fixed supply of base money is the right thing. Mm. Yeah? It's just the word money is so often used without nuance, even though it's extremely important to distinguish between base money, credit money, and fiduciary media, a money substitute, so to say, created out of thin air, which obviously we don't want. So I think Austrians are very clear on that. And if some of us have, so to say, focused more on the fixed element of money, it's probably due because that's the battle. Yeah, that's the battle which we have as free market proponents versus the statists, which centralized money and essentially created a kind of communist foothold in the economy, which essentially dominates everything. So you can't ever really say we have a free market economy, a capitalistic economy, which is productive, growing, and progressive, if you have this central planner hiding in plain sight.
Yeah. So I think we can agree, generally speaking, again, quoting Hayek here, that the central theme is crystal clear. Government has failed, must fail, and will continue to fail to supply good money. And I think all of us here know that and we understand that. And it really then comes down into the implementation of, well, what does a new system look like? And again, the denationalization of money in the 1970s, this is coming off the back of the inflation of the 1970s, which was incredibly damaging to a lot of economies. Interestingly, my understanding was a lot of it was it wasn't the oil shock per se, but it was the response to the oil shock from nation states that led to that inflation.
As usual, yes.
And so I think Bitcoin is, as anyone who's prudent would understand, that the state doesn't have the right incentives. And this is maybe something that we can talk about just to kind of begin this journey to step through the logic of the importance of credit money.
Yeah.
So talking about incentives, how do incentives play into the nature of good money, and maybe in terms of, say, how the government approaches incentives when it comes to money?
Let's start with what you just said. It was that it was the response of the governments to the oil price shock which caused the whole thing.
Yeah? Yeah.
I mean, ever since we had fiat money, early 1900s, the regulation of the money supply was not anymore a spontaneous market process. It was centrally planned, like the Soviet Union or any communist state. Yeah, and so what did these guys do to regulate the amount of money? They measured inflation with CPI, consumer price index, producer price index, you know, all these kinds of things, leaving out the asset price mostly. Asset price inflation, and then they were very confused and puzzled when they adjusted the money supply according to the CPI and still had problems. Yeah, and why is that? I mean, you don't need to know much about Austrian school to know the resolution. The price shocks which come in certain sectors for various fundamental reasons should not trigger a monetary response. Yeah. So if computers get cheaper, yeah, it doesn't mean you need to change the money supply of base money. Yeah, if oil gets more expensive, that also doesn't mean it. It just means that oil is now dearer. We should reduce our use of oil in favor of other things. Yeah? And to try to cancel out that correct adjustment of quantities is just completely wrong.
And so with that, that's responding to political pressure, that's responding to maybe demands upon the government to do something about it, right? And this, I think, again, we all know this, you know, this is a pretty obvious Bitcoin story. We understand that the government is kind of bound to do this. And yet this role of incentives comes in. So that led to this period of 1970s, high inflation. Following that, there was innovations in central banking, you know, quote unquote innovations that led to central bank independence. And in a sense, there was the introduction of some kind of incentives. And again, quoting Hayek, he talks about how New Zealand, my home country, that brought in incentives for the governor of the Reserve Bank to target and hit those inflation rates. And so started to bring in some kind of mechanism to hold somebody responsible. And yet still we have massive inflation when the political winds push it in a certain way, and in a sense central bank independence is arguably not as independent as it might seem on paper. And so the story of Bitcoin, the story of private banking, the story of Austrians is that we can actually get the state out of this, we can separate money and state, and here we are today with a very, very good opportunity with Bitcoin, yet it hasn't usurped the role of fiat in business supply chains. And so it's kind of like, well, what's the missing piece here? That was the opening question. What is the missing piece here? And I think you alluded to this a little bit, Hubertus, this idea of the different layers of money. And so maybe we can come into there and sort of start with base layer money. What does that mean for Bitcoin? What is base layer?
Well, the first thing which is important to know, that if you have a perfectly secure claim to money, you can pass on that claim in payment of things, just like you could pass on money. So, for instance, if you have a banknote, we can discuss whether banknotes are a wise thing, but if you have a banknote and it's perfectly secure that the bank will make good on it, then everybody will accept it, particularly if that banknote has, let's say, some practical advantages to gold. Yeah, like it's less heavy, it's more divisible, all these nice things which you have with symbolic money. The layers which you are alluding to come from the fact that there are two kinds of money necessary in an ideal money system, but the problem is there are other types of money possible. And as well as the missing needed layer of money, as well as the fake possible layer of money, which we should not accept anymore, they are all based on credit. Yeah? Credit, which is nominally repayable in base money, but credit, which can also fulfill the function of money in a good fashion, in the case of real credit money, and in a bad fashion, in the case of bad credit money, or let's call it fiduciary media, to use a very old-fashioned Austrian term for it. So there are these three possibilities, and the fiat system is a perversion of all of it, because it's entirely made up of bad credit money. The base money, which we are working in, made by a central bank, is essentially 90% more these days credit money in terms of government bonds. So which we call in a bit flippant way out of thin air, but it just means there's no real business activity, no production, no supply chain behind that money. It's pure future consumption of governments and the future income they have from taxes, which so to say give some form of assurance that this claim will be honored at some stage. But of course we all know they don't do that. They just blow up the deficit year by year ever since we had fiat money. So what we need to focus on as Bitcoiners are these two good layers of money which are needed for the economy. One is the base money layer. We all know it, love it. It's the 21 million Bitcoin. You need proof of work to produce Bitcoin, energy, ASICs, facilities. And the same is true for real money, real credit money, which may only be issued against real goods being produced and going into the supply chain. And the important thing to know when we talk about elastic money is that this money is produced as a medium of exchange against real goods when they enter the supply chain. And it must be destroyed, burned, when those goods leave the supply chain and go to the ultimate consumer. That's the moment when credit money must be destroyed again. Of course, this is very hard to understand because it's a continuous process. Yeah? There are continuously goods being fed into the supply chain, and there are continuously goods being bought out of it. So this breathing credit money layer, you can also call it elastic, is what makes, what will make Bitcoin work in the real economy, without which the real economy simply cannot function, mostly because of that, what we discussed before, that if you just have a fixed layer, a constant quantity of money, as Hayek called it in Denationalization of Money, full employment and productive rich abundant society is impossible, because it's impossible to keep up division of labor.
Yeah. So something I want to say as well, I bring up this topic with my Bitcoin friends, and I know none of us have to argue the fact that if you hold Bitcoin, it goes up, number go up. That's a pretty clear thing. But the issue is, again, as you say, if you're in an industry that has tight margins, whether it's up or down, it can really mess with your ability to deliver a product or service, and even for your business partners. An increase in appreciation or depreciation can cause a lot of issues. And again, to quote Hayek here, when it comes to private money, it is conceivable that a limited amount of notes of an appreciating currency might be issued and used for special purposes, but it would seem most unlikely that they would become generally used. The chief demand for holding would probably be for the currency in which people expect to have to pay debts. And it seems to me the case at the moment is we've got half the story, Hubertus. We've got a very, very good base money that goes up in value. But yes, in most situations outside of, say, investing in Bitcoin related derivatives, it's very hard to put that Bitcoin to work in the real economy because it's so volatile, right? And so
exactly.
You're almost playing on hard mode with something that can bounce up and down 10% in a day. And that's just really hard to run a business on, right? And so the actual alternative of a slowly depreciating fiat currency, in fact, despite what we may believe, is a little bit, it's more appealing to a business because they know at least that it's going to hold its value day to day. And so again, coming back to this idea of elasticity, another thing that Hayek says is keeping the quantity of money constant does not assure that the money stream will remain constant. And in order to make the volume of money stream behave in a desired manner, the supply of money must possess considerable elasticity. And this is exactly what you said, this credit layer on top of a hard money base layer. So maybe we can just elucidate a little bit more on that, because it's maybe a little bit hard for people to visualize. As you say, it's a flow, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the problem is that the narrative has gotten a little bit out of hand. Yeah. Within Bitcoin. Yeah, I think in the very beginning, the very first discussions which we read on P2P Foundation between Satoshi and the first people discussing that, people who knew about private money, for instance, because they were from these German, regional money aficionados, I almost want to say, these fans who, despite the difficulty, tried to establish regional money systems like the Rheingold guys, yeah, or the Chiemseer guys around the Chiemsee in Germany, which still exist, yeah.
And there's one in Strasbourg as well, the Stuck, I think it's called. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple of them. I couldn't even put a number on that, Cody. So yeah, but they're around. But what you said is completely correct. So, for instance, what we've seen so far in economies which break down is that they, unfortunately, because of what we just talked about before, the impossibility of businesses to adopt Bitcoin while it's so volatile, they turn to stablecoin. Yeah, I recently saw a recording of Peter McCormack from a while ago, where he visited Lebanon, yeah, which, as we all know, broke down in 2019 after some shenanigans of the boss of the central bank. And people did not switch to Bitcoin. Yeah, they did not switch to Bitcoin. They switched to US dollar-based stablecoins. The countries which lose their faith into their own fiat currency, they switch to dollar. Yeah, even El Salvador, where Bitcoin still is nominally legal tender, maybe not in the traditional sense, which the statists want, but it is legal. Even there, it didn't take root. And when I was there for adopting Bitcoin last year in November, I was actually told by people that the businesses get kind of negative on Bitcoin, because they put everything in place to be able to accept Bitcoin, and then nobody comes along, or very few people come along to pay with Bitcoin. It might be the odd Bitcoiner from foreign countries coming along, and that's it. And then they have one transaction every half year, and it's just not enough to warrant the attention, the significant know-how which you need with today's Bitcoin to keep these things up. So Hayek, of course, is correct here. You need this elasticity. But we must be very careful. He did not say that the base money layer needs to be elastic. Yeah, he was for money which was pegged or even in a certain form redeemable into competing commodities. Mm. But he did not yet know about digital commodities, of course. Yeah? Mm. So he thought of various kinds of metals and other commodities. So that can be fixed. And then if you add the elastic credit money layer, then of course also the total is elastic, because fixed plus elastic as a total system, what you can observe if you were a central bank, for instance, means that the total is elastic. They don't distinguish those two components anymore. Mm. So that's why we need the credit money layer.
You know what's interesting as well? So I picked up on that piece of the commodity money which Hayek talks about. Mm. And he actually is quite clear that token money, paper money, is probably a better idea than gold in his context. But that was a token money that was redeemable maybe in other token monies or in commodities, other commodities, as far as I understand. The limits of gold, he seems to be quite clear about. Maybe if you want to expand on that. But he seemed to think that having a number of competing currencies that maybe hold each other is a way of doing it that's maybe perhaps better than gold, which has got a geographic distribution. There's some challenges there. What do you think about that?
Yeah, there was also what you just mentioned was a significant amount of debate, and it gets, so to say, even more confusing, let's say, for the normie, because at later Hayek correctly clarified that there are two types of competition going on. Yeah, it's on one, the competition, what's the better base money? Well, fiat money, of course, central bank fiat money is the worst kind of base money you can think about. It's unlimited because governments can make unlimited debt. And they are prone to do that. But is it gold? Is it silver? Is it a digital currency? My personal opinion is that the digital currency is way, way preferable to the digital commodity is way, way preferable to physical commodity, because governments will always be able to get their dirty little fingers on physical commodities simply by, you know, confiscating it. Bitcoiners know about that, you know, the executive orders and things. So that with Bitcoin, it's very hard for interventionism for politicians to do that. So this is one competition, and the other competition, which Hayek in the 1978 version of the book expanded, said, was the competition of people. He didn't say it in those words, but issuing currency, meaning credit money, on top of whatever is the best commodity. So there's the competition between, for instance, gold, Bitcoin, if you want Ethereum, and things on one layer. And then there will be a competition, which is not happening at all yet, to issue credit money on top of such base monies. So that's completely missing, not only in Bitcoin, but also in the shitcoiner sphere.
Yeah.
They all talk about formulaic adjustment of the quantity of money, and that's impossible. Satoshi knew that. He said it verbatim. We know it from as we discussed already, that the central banks can't do it with the CPI. It's just impossible. It needs to be a market process where those businesses who need to create credit money can do so. And here's the important thing, and there was this interesting podcast which Tucker Carlson had recently with Richard Werner. I don't know if you've seen
yes.
it.
Yeah. Yes.
So here's the funny thing about Werner. Yeah. So he correctly said that credit creation for speculation and for consumption is a very bad idea. Yeah. It's so to say unlimited. But he was very outspoken about that the creation of credit money, or just money as he called it, for production is a very important thing. Yeah, he was very clear about that. So, unfortunately, he then argues that the central banks need to take care of that, which they can't. Yeah, but it's very interesting. So, what we need to do as Bitcoiners, who understand proof of work, is we understand proof of work to create base money. The next thing we need to understand is that the real economy also does proof of work when they produce goods. Yeah, there's always a limited amount of goods in the supply chain, and that proof of work is what must back the valid, the real credit money layer. If we ensure that, we will be fine. We will have the most stable currency which we ever had, and there will possibly be a competition on various ways to produce Bitcoin-based credit money, and some of them may have good quality credit money and others may have bad quality credit money, and they will drop out by a very natural market selection principle, because they simply will go bankrupt.
Yeah. Can you just clarify? I think this is important that we get this right. So just having a look back through Hayek, and he says here, better even than gold, that there is just not enough gold about. An international gold standard could today mean only that a few countries maintained a real gold standard while the others hung on to them through a gold exchange standard, which sounds a little bit like Bretton Woods to me. Mm. And so I'm just trying to conceptualize, and maybe we can linger on this point, the idea of a redeemability into a commodity, whether it's gold or Bitcoin, at a base layer is one thing. And it seems... And maybe I need to read this closer, but it seems that Hayek also talks about the idea that the value of the credit layer is based on its ability to hold a stable price, however that is done. And they're kind of almost two different mechanisms. I'm just trying to think how we sort of connect those two in a way.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's a very good point, Cody. If it's done correctly, if the yeah. credit money layer is based on real goods, what's happening? Yeah, it's actually much simpler than meets the eye. If credit money is only generated when goods enter the channel, enter the supply chains, there was a fair price negotiated between the buyer and the seller. Whatever that is, it could be very situational. Yeah, I mean, a tank of water is more valuable in the desert than here, right beside the Danube River in Vienna. So it's very situational, and it's the buyer and the seller each do their best to get the best bargain for their side. So the seller obviously wants more money, the buyer wants to pay less. Wherever they meet, it's an objective truth. It's the negotiated actual price. And what happens if you create medium of exchange, credit money, at that moment, which works by a very well-known instrument called the bill of exchange, that's why it's called so, and they agree, for instance, to pay this credit after, let's say, 90 days, 3 months, then within that period, these goods stay in the channel and they are being sold to consumers only in the end. And it is the value of those goods which stabilizes the money. And we have to take into consideration that the credit money layer is way, way bigger than the base money layer. I mean, Hayek reported in Theory of Money and Credit a factor of 10. Jevons, about 50 years later, reported a factor of 1 to 20 credit money over base money on gold. Mm. So there's much, much more credit money available than base money. But that's actually not even the important thing, because the holding, the storing of base money, it will end up in some wallet somewhere. And it will be needed to verifiably finalize the repayment, the cancellation of credit money. Yeah. Mm. So it's the constant production of credit money which stabilizes the price of money, because the quantity of demand when shifting is met with a adjusting quantity of supply, and what adjusts the quantity of supply is the so-called discount rate, or in a Bitcoin system, we probably call it better the minting fee of Bitcoin-based credit money. So as the demand for money, total money, credit money plus base money, rises, the minting fee to mint imperfect credit into perfect credit money will rise, and as demand goes down, that fee will fall. So that's the spontaneous order which the free market can give to it, and it will produce the money exactly there where it's needed. So to go back to your example of the oil price shock, yeah. So when the oil producing countries increased the price of oil, it was not the total economy which all of a sudden needed more money. Yeah, it was those people who needed to buy oil. Yeah, to put it into refineries, to put it in warehouses, to distribute it to service stations to store it until finally a car comes by and fills up the tank. So it was only that specific part of the money supply which needed to expand, to adjust to the new system. And the central banks can't do that. They look at the CPI and think, oh, CPI is going up. We need to increase the quantity of money by giving it to the government to spend, which is crazy.
So here's a context then. So what you've just explained, to be fair, there's a little bit of complexity there. I think some people might listen to that and struggle to follow along. But I think and it's okay. We'll elucidate. I've just got this concept, though, that I've just come up with. So looking at Hayek, he again talks about the idea of convertibility, which, still talking at this base layer, he says convertibility is a safeguard necessary to impose upon a monopolist but unnecessary with competing suppliers. Now, that would argue that, you know, maybe it's not needed, but the reality is we are living in a system of a monopoly money, which is the state is issuing money. And so, in a sense, you know, and this was, you know, written a long time ago, is it possible that the innovation that allows us to now be in a position where we can realistically consider the possibility of private money that is separate to the state, is because Bitcoin has given us this private peer-to-peer censorship-resistant base layer that we can then use to disrupt the monopoly, which for it to organically work, it would be maybe quite challenging, right? You know, there's been attempts in the past, in the 90s and that with various digital monies, but because they didn't have that base layer right, they sort of struggled to really make any headways, right?
And so now, they tried to adjust the base layer instead of distinctly separating those two layers. Yeah.
Oh, and also the decentralization, right? They got shut down. Let's be real. You know, these various digital currencies in the 90s, they just couldn't stand up to the federal government of the United States. You know, so if we think of that as the innovation that has meant that we can now have a very serious conversation about this becoming a global monetary system, that is the innovation, perhaps, that we've got a censorship resistant base, we've got a decentralized base money. Now, just kind of expanding upon this, though, the reality is, as we discussed in the beginning, there is no supply chains, there's no factories. People, you often have to give a discount if you want to, you know, get Bitcoin. You know, there's all of these things that are kind of strange when it is the hardest money we know. And so, kind of diving into this idea of a credit layer, maybe you can tell me more about sort of what this means, because people get allergic to this word credit, right? This idea that there's going to be trusted parties involved, there's going to be banks. You know, I thought Bitcoin was about, you know, getting rid of the banks, becoming your own bank. There's all of this kind of narrative out there. Can we maybe expand on exactly what we're talking about here? Is it about bringing banks back into the system? Sorry.
No, it's more or less it's the opposite. Yeah.
Okay.
It means getting banks, all kinds of banks, out of the system for part of it.
Okay.
Yeah, so banks will be needed, but they have both central banks and commercial banks have right now usurped. I don't even know how you pronounce that word in English.
usurped
the creation of money, and they shouldn't.
Okay.
Yeah? Gold can be perfectly produced without banks. Yeah, you just need a mint to mint it in value units. Yeah, Bitcoin can be perfectly produced without the government, without central banks. It's in fact, we all worried about making sure it stays decentralized enough.
Yep.
And the same is true for credit money. Banks should not be allowed to produce credit money. And
okay.
here is a fine line where I think even the Austrian school is sometimes not specific enough, because when you produce credit money, it must be produced only from credit. And as long as it's production companies granting each other that credit against real goods which are going in the supply chain, it is in reality the production companies which produce the credit which is necessary for perfection to become credit money. So what I'm saying is, as long as we make 100% sure as Bitcoiners that the credit which is used to enhance it into fungible, divisible, symbolic money for Bitcoin, we call it Bitcredit for the Bitcredit protocol. As long as we make sure that that's only used as productive credit, we'll be fine. There will be no inflation, because the goods which go into the supply chain, they are proof of work. And when they are being consumed, those bills of exchange are automatically repaid or paid, as it's called, and that credit money disappears again. So that's and the reason why Bitcoiners correctly are so allergic to credit is that this principle has been completely perverted. Because of what happened, we're all thinking today of banks to give us credit. But in the future, the banks will essentially not do any more demand deposits, because we Bitcoiners, we will hold both base money as well as credit money self-sovereign in our own wallets. Not your keys, not your coin. That's true for credit money. That's true for and the trick how this all came about, if you allow me, it became into being after the Peel Act in the United Kingdom in 1844, when they, so to say, correctly restricted the issuance of banknotes to essentially be warehouse receipt backed by gold, and they did not allow any other credit creation by banks, but they left out, unfortunately, the bills of exchange. So what happened is that all of a sudden the banks created demand deposits, with which people could dispose of via paying with checks. So that's bank money creation of the bad kind, but it was necessary because otherwise the British economy would have broken down. And in fact, for the first 3 years after the Peel Act 1844, we did see substantial pressures in the economic system. It's just people didn't realize what it was, and so to say, the solution to accept demand deposits of banks as money was very obvious. But this is a wrong solution. Yeah? The correct solution is that mints take credit produced by the real economy, by production, and mint it into fungible Bitcoin credit units. So let's shorten it to the name of Bit credits or just credits in the future. Yeah. So that's the correct process.
Okay, because we talk about demand deposits. That is probably actually how a lot of people think about their bank account, right? They're not using cash, like physical cash. They're using their checking account.
Yeah.
And that is just numbers in a spreadsheet somewhere that can be given to someone to buy a house from the bank, right?
Yeah, unlimited.
Unlimited. And so this is very interesting. So I think I'm beginning to get an idea, the idea of sort of what we're talking about here is it's bringing... I almost think coming back to like agricultural examples, it's like you've got this seed, right? There's these, you know, these things that this capital, you know, original capital, and it can become, you know, food. It can become something, or you can eat the seed, and there's a potential energy in there. And with credit that's based on production, you know, there will be some wheat come out of this, or in the case of timber, there will be some manufactured good that comes out of this. That actually is the bridge between the real world, the real economy, and the financial economy. And again, you can't eat paper, you can't live off that. You live off the real economy. That is what gives us prosperity.
Exactly. Yeah.
And in a sense, this modern project where the financialization of everything, in a sense, that mirror of the financial economy has become tarnished. It's not reflecting the reality of the productive economy. And so you do get the classic business cycle, boom and bust, and misallocation of capital and all these issues that we're aware of, right? Speculative bubbles as well when it comes to housing. But this is still, I think, I know it's just we're limited on time here, Hubertus, but this is still, I think, a little bit complicated for people who are used to the simple narratives of fixed supply, of HODL, you know, hold your Bitcoin, these kinds of things. But that has still led us to the case here we are 16 years later, where, you know, there's no production, there's no
what I would remind people of, it's the question, where do you want to be? It's nice for each of us wanting to be safe. We put some of our wealth in Bitcoin. While it's not 100% sure assured that Bitcoin will win, we probably should also still keep a bit of gold, and thereby escape the fiat scam. But what we must be aware of as Bitcoiners, just because we are personally safe, it doesn't mean that essentially the economy can get better. We will still have inflation if the economy runs on fiat. We will still have boom busts because the banks can create money for speculation and for consumption instead of just for production. We will still have asset price inflation because money being created for speculation then instead of just for production. As part of the asset price inflation, there will still be people who try to protect their net worth, not only in Bitcoin, not only in gold, but also in houses and real estate, which makes houses unaffordable for the younger generation, with all the implication that has on our values, on family, on you know, the social fabric. And of course, they can will still be able to print for war and all kinds of stupid ideas which the politicians have daily. Yeah, I mean, I always say, look, if you have a venture, found one, and you try to get venture money, every venture is fully aware that 90 to 95% of new ideas are rubbish, whereas the politicians can implement all those ideas without any market control whether they're actually damaging.
Yeah. Well, I do hope people are still with us at this point. And I guess coming back to what I'm trying to do here, which is, you know, understand what's going on, because there is maybe the simple argument that, you know, we're just early, that, you know, this thing just continues going up in value. And then at some point, you know, it is it gets used more and more. But I mean, the reality is, you know, it's as I said, it's pretty hard to get a cafe up the road to accept Bitcoin, and it's a much even harder thing to get them to pay their employees in Bitcoin, and then for those employees to then buy their own groceries in Bitcoin, and so on and so forth. It's an uphill battle, and so I think what I'm looking for is kind of a level-headed analysis of like the situation, which I know you're looking at with BitCredit. Certainly the Austrians have given us some material to work with, but something's up, and as you say, we might, you know, we might be okay. Personally, we, you know, number go up, you know, we have a stack. But if there is the continual degradation of fiat money, that has some real implications, because in a case where the real economy is massively impacted, how much stuff can you actually buy with Bitcoin when, you know, your economy is actually in a recession or a depression, right? There's some connection there.
Yeah, exactly. So we will still have this production misallocation distorted because of fiat money. But what's even more important, and I think I proposed a debate here to adopting Bitcoin in El Salvador these days. I think that it is actually an absolute impossibility for Bitcoin to remain a store of value, medium or long term, if we don't also get it to win as a medium of exchange. So I hope adopting Bitcoin will record the debate. But the argument is very simple. Right now, we have a little bit of breathing space because of, you know, the attitude of the Trump administration towards Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, which is, so to say, accommodating. But there could be a political change tomorrow, and some other politicians in the world, particularly in Europe, are still very authoritarian and are continuing to buy to build the mass surveillance state and so to say the communist model of central planning, price controls, and all these things are happening as we speak. So I'm saying it is impossible for Bitcoin to remain a store of value, because the politicians will build new laws, new regulations, new punishments to avoid that Bitcoin can be exchanged into fiat, which is necessary if Bitcoin is only store of value. And once they get out with the CBDCs, they will have total control about that. They will, if you sell Bitcoin for fiat in CBDC, they can just switch it off. And that's, to me, that's very clear, and that's the end. Mm-hmm. Yeah? There might be other countries where they still have that, but that's the end also of the store of value. Whereas if we do what's needed so that the real economy can accept Bitcoin, that if we have the credit money layer, which always used to be what's called to fund the so-called wage fund, with which people working for businesses get paid and then buy goods. If we get that going, even just in a small area to play out correctly, then we have an insurance for that day when they switch on CBDC.
Yeah, this is, I think this is important. And again, I appreciate this truth that we're trying to find together, Hubertus. Maybe not that many people are talking about this, but, you know, Hayek, if you look at his writing from 78, he was very pessimistic about the idea of the euro, which I don't think, it was just a glimmer in a few people's eyes, some authoritarians. Hmm. But now, as you say, today, we are in a state where the EU has become this totalitarian monster, exactly what Hayek was warning about, you know, in the 70s, and it has come to fruition. And so I think we do need to look at that with clear eyes and not maybe rest on our pride and our hubris that number go up because of a favorable US administration. Going back to the original idea of this whole thing is that we separate money and state. And I think the questions we're asking today and the questions that I hope I can explore again, maybe we expand on this with you again soon, but how can we actually achieve that? Because as you say, when you've got real economy, real production, real factories out there who are integrated and intimate with Bitcoin, they're not just holding it as a nice to have that's going to, you know, line their pockets, but it's actually essential and part of their production. It's part of their supply chains. It's in their contracts. That's what's going to give bargaining power and political power to this project, I think.
I mean, it's the right question and answers, damn if I know it, Cody. It's actually what's keeping lots of the people involved in the BitCredit initiative up at night. How do we do it? How do we make sure that Bitcoiners understand and that we do the correct credit money there? Sorry, you said.
Yeah. So just quickly then, on this debate at adopting Bitcoin, who are you hoping to talk with on that? Or has that already happened?
I don't know, but I think there's 99% of Bitcoiners who think that the SOV story can go on forever, so there won't be a lack of people to argue against medium of exchange. Funnily enough, Jack Dorsey recently seemed to have made a couple of comments, and given his following, that probably has much more weight than a little project like BitCredit, even though it's spreading throughout the world. So there's more and more countries where people said, yeah, we want to have that. We want to talk to real economies, try to orange pill them. So that's growing very organically. But of course, somebody like Jack Dorsey has a huge following. And when he says, guys, go back on medium of exchange, that has power. Yeah.
Yeah. Just in our last few minutes then, Hubertus, tell me more just about BitCredit. So where is the project at and kind of what stage are you guys at? Any updates on that front?
Earlier this the project right now is probably a dozen or so extremely active core people writing code and thinking through the, let's say, the business part of how to make that happen, growing rapidly. We had a full working prototype ready in Q1 this year, which we demoed. You can find it on Twitter, the account of the initiative, which is bitcr_org. Where we recorded how it works. It's essentially this wholesale money layer made of bills of exchange between businesses, between production businesses, which then is given to mints, who enhance this credit with a guarantee and make the bill of exchange divisible into mini bills, as we call them. And we essentially used Cashew as a base to build a new form of mint, which we're calling Wildcat, which is a credit mint. And those Wildcats make these bills of exchange divisible and into a payment instrument, because we discussed before, a perfect claim to money is like money. It's just perfect claim to base money is credit money is money. So you can use this with eCash in so to say, every Bitcoiner's dream of how a payment should be. It's absolutely no fees. It's absolutely instant. It is scalable to whatever number of transactions you want in the world. It is perfectly fungible, which of course means that it's also private and non-censorable, because if something is not private and therefore censorable, it cannot ever be fungible. So it's essentially the ideal money. So I really love it. And the difficulty is really the chicken-egg problem. How do we get committed businesses to do at least a little bit of their supply chain business in Bitcoin while it is so volatile? That's the nut we need to crack now.
Yeah, and I think eCash is very interesting, and it seems like there's more and more interest in that space where it is a very smooth and kind of elegant system. I mean, obviously, payments on chain and payments with Lightning have an infrastructure cost. There is sort of overhead for the user, but with eCash, it's kind of a more simple instrument in a sense, because it's higher up the stack. You know, it is a lot easier and lighter weight, from my understanding, to use for actual payments, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is. And the problem with Xiaomi eCash, ever since its foundation, was that it's custodial. No, this is also at least my interpretation why David Chaum originally, apart from some personality problems, failed to get it going. Yeah. And Satoshi, so to say, did refer to eCash when building Bitcoin. And so to say, the what we have also now in Bitcoin is, so to say, back to the roots. There are two projects, Fedimint and Cashew, which tried the Chaum and eCash specifically on Bitcoin, and as I said, I think the better one to build upon with some pretty big changes is Cashew, because it needs to be made non-custodial. Yeah, if we can't get like Bitcoin, if we can't get eCash to be non-custodial, governments, politicians will be able to do their usual thing to capture it ultimately. So mm-hmm. So that's the effort which is ongoing right now, knocking on wood that we'll be able to present non-custodial eCash latest in Q4 this week, Q4 this year, excuse me. Yeah. And then I think the system is ready to be released in the wild. It probably will take some 2-3 years for hardening. But the idea is to harden the system and be ready when the next fiat currency collapses. They collapse all the time, as we know. Nobody knows where. Maybe it's Bolivia or wherever. And be ready when the next country is looking for something, and they hopefully don't switch to stables, but then to a Bitcoin which can stabilize.
Yeah, interesting. That's fascinating, and thanks for sharing this. I do appreciate this as a complex topic. I'm going to have to do a bit more reading on this. Certainly diving into the Austrian classics has given me some more insight into the way we can look at this, but it is an ongoing conversation. I think the takeaway is certainly that we cannot rest on our laurels. Bitcoin isn't guaranteed as much as the number furnishes our egos that we were right. That can also go away when political forces come into play, because there's no claims on the real economy as it stands. It is all just speculative. There's some good properties there, but once it's actually embedded into supply chains and factories and businesses, that's got a lot more power. I appreciate that from you, Hubertus. If people want to find out more as well, the website bit.cr. People can go there, check out BitCredit. I think you've even got a demo people can download, right?
Yeah, there's a demo video on, as I already mentioned, bitcr_org on X. We're probably going to upload on the BitCR page too. The BitCR page is dedicated to wholesale money, so the bills of exchange essentially between businesses. We will very soon now have a retail-oriented website showing the wallet with which you can use those divisible mini bills, just like you would be using a Lightning wallet today, essentially. Self-custodial, so like Phoenix or like Breeze, these types of things, but non-custodial. Expected also in Q4. Meanwhile, we are working hard trying to find the odd Bitcoiner in the trade finance segment of banking, to start talking to businesses to adopt it. So any Bitcoiner who is hearing this podcast and knows a real economy businesses with a Bitcoiner who might want to do this with a couple of sats, please point them into our directions. And this is going to be the way to orange bill businesses and not just Bitcoin as store of value.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you very much, Hubertus.
Thanks, Cody. Goodbye. Speak soon.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.